seated, please.
Court is ready to hear argument in 06-0574-20801, Inc. versus John L. Parker.
Mr. Andis will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The safe harbor provision of the Texas Dram Shop Act, according to past Texas jurisprudence, is much like the human appendix. We have it, but it serves no useful function. Further, with the precision of a surgeon, the courts have opened up the Dram Shop Act and simply excised the safe harbor provision completely out of the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Code, at least in practice. To date, no court of appeals has ever found that a retailer, provider of alcoholic beverages, has ever satisfied the safe harbor provision. I'm wary of the discussion of legislative history that we just heard, but I'll be brief on that point. And that is to say that the statute itself, as well as the scant legislative history we have, fortunately there's no the safe harbor provision was designed to provide an incentive or encouragement to retailers. That is, it's designed to cut off the vicarious liability of the retailer for the act of the employee in violating the law. As this court is well aware, Section 106.14a of the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Code states in relevant part that the actions of an employee shall not be attributable to the employer if, one, the employer requires its employees to attend a commission-approved seller training program, two, the employee has actually attended such a training program, and three, and this is the one that really is at issue, the employer has not directly or indirectly encouraged the employee to violate such law.
So all you have to do is to file an affidavit and say that it's your company's policy never to overserve customers, and that be that.
Well, Justice Green, the Pena case has decided that that wasn't enough. It was a conclusory affidavit, and I would submit to you that under the allocation of the burden of which party should bear what burden, which I think is in our brief, that actually wouldn't even be reached because of the fact that the plaintiff would come back and say, here's how they encourage violations of the law.
But it is an affirmative defense.
Well, that's one of the questions, Your Honor, is all three elements an affirmative defense, or simply the affirmative defense could fit within the first two elements and leave the third element, that the employer does not encourage violations of the law, let that be a plaintiff's burden to prove. The employer could show that it requires all of its, well, first of all, it would plead the affirmative defense, would show that it requires all of its employees to attend a TABC-approved training class, that, in fact, the employee that served the alleged plaintiff or whatever the source of the incident was TABC certified. If that burden is met, it would then shift to the plaintiff to show how the employer encourages violations of the law. As it stands right now, all three elements being on the retail provider is left trying to prove a negative. And in fact, the way that the case law to date has come out, the retailer can't do it simply because he can't think of all the various ways of things that he didn't do that become encouragement to violate the law. For example, he didn't put in enough video cameras. He didn't say the right magic words in his written policy. Those are the types of acts that the retailers are actually being snared by when they go to prove the safe harbor defense. So, in fact, because they have to prove a negative, because the courts have considered all three elements to be an affirmative defense.
Well, but I'm just trying to think of an analogy in the citation cases. If you, don't answer and you lost the papers, we've said it's not enough just to say I lost the papers, I think. You have to get an affidavit from the person who's most likely to have gotten them to say what your procedures are and what you've tried to do to find them and stuff like that. I mean, there's a difference between, and in this case, we've got a seven-page affidavit from the manager who says, I was there, I met this guy, and this is what was happening that night. I mean, that's a little more than just saying, we follow the law. And what was the response to that?
There was no response.
Well, I mean, the plaintiffs say, they overserved me.
Right.
Anything more? What would a plaintiff do to overcome that on summary judgment in your
Well, I think that the plaintiff would be responsible for putting together some discovery product that says, well, despite what he's saying, here's evidence that...
Talk to former employees and say they did this and this was my practice.
Right, or this night in particular, he says that, but we have other witnesses who testified that he said, yeah, go ahead and keep serving the guy. He's falling down, he's falling off the chairs that he's sitting on, but the manager or another the manager tells an employee or the provider tells the manager, go ahead and keep serving the guy. That would be one way to overcome an affidavit such as the one we presented, Justice Brister.
So maybe it's like an official immunity kind of a case where the police officer comes in and files an affidavit showing good faith, his good faith in the acting the way he did, and it falls upon the other side to prove bad faith.
Perhaps, Your Honor. Again, this is a unique code in that it's a statute.
Safe harbor is sort of like an immunity in a way, I guess.
It appears that's the intent of the legislature, was to provide, and I believe this court has even said, a relatively easy out for the provider of alcoholic beverages, in that the idea was to get education into the front line where the servers are actually interacting with the customers. And I don't know exactly what the thinking was, but it makes sense that if your frontline people are your most educated and they were trained by TABC, I mean, these aren't classes that the providers, that the retailers do. It's not like they say, come in our offices and we're going to teach you a few things. These are classes the retailers don't have a hand in.
But the legislature, the statute shows that the legislature assumed that there are some people, some owners who, despite having put their employees through the classes and having them become certified, would encourage or allow, permit their employees to serve someone who's obviously intoxicated, perhaps for an economic reason. You know, they make more money when they sell alcohol. And so why wouldn't that be part of the defendant's burden to say, no, that's not, that didn't happen, to negate that that possibility in a summary judgment context.
Right. Justice Jefferson, we've tried that. We have tried to make it part of the defendant's burden to date. And the case law and what has happened is it's turned into a shell game. There's no definitive definition in any of the courts that gives the provider the guidelines for what we do. And so what ends up happening is providers get nailed by innocent acts, things that that they could not reasonably foresee. And so what our proposal is to say the legislature didn't create a get-out-of-jail-free card entirely without – so all the provider has to do is send its employees to TABC training and keep them certified. That's why they threw in the third element, which is to make sure, I believe, that they don't undermine – that the providers do not undermine the training that the employees have received. The first question for the court for us is, you know, how do we allocate that burden and what is required to show what encouragement is or what encouragement is not? And at least practically speaking, the way it has worked to date, it's proving a negative, which is, in my experience in the case law, is proven hard to do, well, actually impossible to do. Speaking of the prior cases, there are, I believe, not counting the case out of the 14th Court of Appeals, there are five prior cases that discuss the safe harbor provision in Texas. Again, this is not a provision that I believe we can look to other states for some guidance on because I've not been able to find any other similar type of law in another state, at least with respect to the provision of alcohol service.
If we have to take the summary judgment record as true.
Yes.
And if the respondent were served 10 to 15 drinks, two of them by the manager, all of them in violation of the policies, is that some evidence that the petitioner indirectly encouraged violation of the policies?
I don't believe it is, Justice Heck.
Why not?
Well, first of all, that is the very act that is the over-service at issue. Again, the idea behind the safe harbor, as I understand it, is to shield the licensed provider from the acts of his employee. We dispute that 10 to 15 free drinks were served, but taking it as a given for summary judgment purposes, that act was the violation of the policy. There's no evidence that, first of all, the act of serving 10 to 15 drinks was encouraged by the licensed provider. And if the provider can't be shielded from the act because the act itself forms the basis of the either the encouragement or the overservice at issue, then there's no way that the safe harbor is ever going to be satisfied.
But I suppose, surely if you had evidence that night after night this was happening, couldn't you infer that there must be either direct or indirect encouragement? I mean, surely employees are not acting over and over and over again in the against the best interests of the proprietor.
That in hypothetical that you just proposed, Justice Act, yes, that may be. It would depend, obviously, on the circumstances of the case. But, yeah,
In addition to the testimony from other employees, we were encouraged to say, turn a blind eye, you could prove up a pattern of behavior.
Yes, Justice Christopher. And I believe that that goes to what encouragement is as opposed to what encouragement isn't, which is you failed to put up enough video cameras. Currently, as the laws have come down, what we've got is the provider, the retailer, finds himself in a position of having to anticipate every possible thing that an expert hired by the plaintiffs could propose after the fact with perfect hindsight and say, well, you didn't do this and you didn't do that. Again, the providers aren't operating in a vacuum. They're operating under the laws of the civil liability laws and the TABC governance under the administrative side of the code. And so providers are also operating with, you know, business parameters. You know, does it make good business sense to put up one camera? Well, gosh, maybe we should put up 10 cameras because, you know, someone's going to come back and say one wasn't enough. Part of the problem, again, is not just what the providers aren't doing. It's how does that relate to encouraging the type of act that's being alleged in this case?
Well, you say it leaves the bar owner exposed here because the safe harbor provision wouldn't apply. But how? I mean, it seems to me this is the plaintiff is going to have a hard time under our precedent proving that the sale caused the injury in this case anyway, right?
You're talking about the proximate cause that the alcohol at issue was.
Yes, I mean if the sale didn't cause under our precedent the Griffin to punch Parker, then you win.
Right.
So I mean, in a lot of these cases, the safe harbor provision is not going to be the crux point anyway. It's going to be did the sale proximately cause the injuries.
Justice Jefferson, I agree that there could be some cases where it's pretty clear that you don't even need the safe harbor because there was no either service to a minor or service to an obviously intoxicated patron. I think, though, that the benefit of the safe harbor provision also, though, comes into play in getting summary judgment without the need to, if that is disputed, if you have a case, and I have had cases where that's disputed, whether someone was, say, served when they were obviously intoxicated to the extent they present a clear danger to themselves and others. The only way to avoid trial then would be to go to summary judgment, and if there is no liability for the provider, because it can escape vicarious liability under the safe harbor, then that is an encouragement and an incentive, and certainly I think the way that the legislature intended this act to be laid out. I do want to say a thing about one of the earlier cases, and that is the Pena versus Neal case, which was, like this one, a summary judgment case coming out of the Court of Appeals in San Antonio in 95. That kind of got us started, I think, on the wrong road, although I don't think with good intention, however. The court said in that case, it looked at the third element, and it said, the employers can't sit back and do nothing, safe in the assumption that they sent their employees to class and they're done. The employer must do more than simply require attendance at training class. And I think from that, we've gone to where we have today, where the employer is literally unable to satisfy the safe harbor because an employer can't do enough to do more. And so here we need guidance from this court to finally say once and for all, what does the third element of the safe harbor provision mean?
What do you think it should mean?
Well, Justice Heck,
we've got two briefs in this case, and one of them says, well, it shouldn't possibly mean this, it shouldn't possibly mean that, but now what should it mean?
Right. I think what it should mean is that we should focus on the word encourage. Encourage is an act. It's an intentional act. It is a directive. It is something overt. I think instead of looking towards what the employer didn't do, we should look at what the employer did do. And that's
or failed to do.
Or, well, failed to do, Justice Brister.
But if they're deliberately indifferent.
I believe there should be a high enough standard, like a conscious indifference standard, so that on failures to act, it has to be high enough so that it clearly encouraged an employee, or there's very little doubt that it would have encouraged the employee. Again, not putting a sentence in your policy, right? We'll fire people if they serve minors, but we didn't happen to say anything in that section about firing someone if they serve obviously intoxicated patrons. Shouldn't be an omission.
How about a manager that we run our operation? We do not want the managers out on the floor. We do not want you to know what's going on. That might be, even though it's a failure to act, there probably should be some should have known aspect to it, or your position is it's got to be intentional?
Well, I believe there's two sides of the encouragement coin. One would be an intentional act, an overt act. You know, go ahead and serve minors. We're okay with that. Another might be, Justice Brister, we don't check IDs. All right. Despite your training at TABC class, we don't check IDs. We don't say anything about it, but we've never checked IDs, or maybe even employees have been disciplined for checking IDs. Because, you know, and so we get a reputation in the community as being a place where minors can come and drink and so forth. That would be my submission. That would be an act of omission.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. McCoy will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Essentially what Mr. Andis is asking the court to do is overturn a couple hundred years of Texas jurisprudence. The first issue is this an affirmative defense? And if it quacks like a duck, looks like a duck, it's probably a duck.
Well, but even it seems to me that kind of distracts from the point, because even if it is an affirmative defense, if he comes in and says we didn't directly or indirectly encourage the employee to violate the law, you're not going to say that's enough.
Well, let's look at what they did have, what they said in their affidavit, and what was actually available under their policy.
But I'm just saying, suppose if it's an affirmative defense,
right?
You don't argue, I take it, that if the defendant comes in and says, "We swear to God that we have not directly or indirectly encouraged the employee to violate such law," that's not going to be the end of it.
No, it's not, because that's a conclusory statement.
So there's going to be some shifting.
And there is going to be some shifting, and that's why I like to just look at what they actually had available to them. They had a lot of policy that showed in the policy in written form that they were not encouraging the sale of alcohol. But everybody knows that actions speak louder than words. Every political scientist who's kind of looked at it would say that the Constitution of the Soviet Union was the most democratic document ever written, but we all know the Soviet Union was a dictatorship. And if you have written policy and you don't really enforce it, the written policy is meaningless.
I think everybody would agree with that. The problem is the way the Court of Appeals opinion is written, It would seem that you would have to establish you'd have to answer the liability question to get to the safe harbor defense.
No, you really would just have to show that actually on the occasion in question that you weren't encouraging the oversell of alcohol, but either directly or indirectly.
But and, just saying, you know, that wouldn't be enough. How would you show it?
Okay, well, let me just go through what we had available in the instant case and what they could have proved had they done it. First of all, the corporate policy created records of no encouragement. There were the drink slips that were monitored by two different people. There were comp slips. There was a policy about not giving free drinks except the manager. Only the manager could do it. So there was actually documentation of no encouragement. But in their summary judgment evidence, they did not introduce any of that evidence that existed. Okay? So they could have actually...
So if the affidavit was more detailed...
Correct. And talked about facts about what occurred that night as opposed to just mere policy.
Well, I mean, it's not just this one instance. I mean, it's directly or indirectly encouraged.
Correct.
I mean, it's...
And you could actually show a pattern of practice if you showed other instances that occurred in the past.
Well,
that they
I'm sure in a lot of cases the manager's not going to remember this night.
Well, In this case, a guy was seriously injured, and this guy was prosecuted, and the police came out and investigated.
Right,
and this manager
fight out
was
the lot, and they sure. But in most cases where they drive off the lot and kill somebody, the manager may not remember the night.
That is correct.
So
but he will have that. If they have the policy like this, he will have the drink slips, he will have the comp slips, he will have written documentation about what occurred that night. And if they had a reasonable retention policy like every modern business has.
But I'm trying to think, you know, in the cases, the stop sign down cases where you can sue the county or the city if they had noticed the stop sign was down.
Correct.
Then the rule is the county or city comes in, says, here's our book. When we get notice, we write it down in this book.
Correct.
And there's nothing in that book for that date, then that's enough.
It's an evidentiary question.
And so it would be
some evidence that as to whether that conclusively proved it might not be. And I would be arguing it wouldn't
be. Well, the other side could come in and contradict it if they want.
Correct.
Haven't we just changed the safe harbor provision? Now the safe harbor provision says don't encourage it directly or indirectly. If your rule's correct, then the fact of the matter is you got to keep these tabs and you got to keep them for a certain number of years of time. And if you don't, then you're out of the safe harbor.
Now, it's a matter of practicality for the business. If they want to be able – it's like businesses – every business does this. I've been involved in litigation with refineries, with all kinds of stuff, and they all have a policy about keeping a retention policy, about keeping documents for a certain period of time. And especially, I guarantee you, if they are exculpatory documents, they're going to be keeping them as long as they need to keep them for potential litigation.
But I don't see what would be wrong with the burden-shifting analogy, because it seems the way it's written – or the way the Court of Appeals decided it, you would require the provider to prove a negative, which is very difficult to do. What would be wrong with, you know, that you didn't directly or indirectly encourage, and then if you knew, then you come back and say, well, the manager served two of the 14 free drinks that were given out, and I've raised a fact issue now.
Well, I think that the problem about proving a negative is kind of a false logic, because we're required in law to prove negatives all the time. Negligence itself is an act or an omission, quote unquote. So the omission is a negative, and so you have to prove a negative in every lawsuit you get practically. And so I don't think that's really the big issue. The big issue is, can you merely, when you have the, and this is why in an affirmative defense, you have the obligation to conclusively prove every element of your affirmative defense. And conclusively prove does not mean a conclusory statement.
So how would you conclusively prove that you neither directly or indirectly encourage violation of the law?
I mean, you would actually, well, for one thing, summary judgment may not be available.
That's the question. That's really what the issue is.
And sometimes there are just some types of cases that summary judgment is not available to them by the nature of the case.
Well, the legislature didn't pass the safe harbor provision to accomplish that, did they?
No. They actually, the context that it was passed, it was actually passed as a reaction to the Court of Appeals decisions in El Chico, in which El Chico created a common law cause of action at the Court of Appeals. The case was pending in the Texas Supreme Court, and the liquor industry went to the Texas Supreme Court, and the legislature then fashioned a restricted Dram Shop Act that was much more restrictive than, you know, what the Court of Appeals had done or what the Supreme Court did 2 days later when they decided El Chico. And at the same time, and Justice Spears in his decision cited the fact that there's a tremendous problem with alcohol, and close to 1,000 people were killed the previous year and many thousands were maimed. We have a situation here where these people are actually selling one of the most dangerous legal drugs made that severely impacts.
Yeah, but prohibition didn't work, so we're not going to.
I understand that, and I have one glass of red wine every night, and I don't want them. You know, I don't want them closing down Specs. Okay, but
counsel, you realize you're on the record.
Well, you know, it was prescribed by my cardiologist. So, but you know, so that's the framework. So they actually have a privilege to sell this legal drug. And because they have this privilege, they have an obligation not to encourage the oversell.
But to return to the analysis again, as I asked you earlier, there has to be some burden shifting here. It's just because the
when they have come
in, has to come in and say, we didn't do anything to encourage this. And
he could have chosen a no evidence motion for summary judgment, Your Honor.
But at that point, then it's incumbent on the plaintiff to say, oh, yes, you did. You did this, this, and this.
Correct.
And then when we get there, are we really talking about a reasonable provider standard? Is that what this boils down to? Or we need a test. And so are we talking about the things that a reasonable provider would do or not do to keep from directly or indirectly encouraging a violation of the law?
I think that might work. And actually, if you look at these cases, and what, of course, Mr. Andis, as a good lawyer, does, he takes the absurd little phrases in them and points that out.
Well, but he says there's no Court of Appeals opinion that's ever found a safe harbor. Is that right?
Correct, but that's not every case that's ever been tried or decided or dealt with in the state of Texas. That's just the cases that got up to that level.
Right.
And so, you know, there's, you know, thousands of cases dealt with, and they're dealt with without the Court of Appeals being involved. But what happened in every one of those cases, though, were places where there was a defect in the manner in which the proponent actually formulated his summary judgment evidence, conclusory statements that don't tell the court any meaningful thing about what they were really doing. And the courts also, in every one of those nearly, I'm sorry, but they also would throw in extra language about some other things that occurred. And it's that extra language that gets us in trouble here today because
I'm wondering about that then on summary judgment. I mean, in this case, the summary judgment is 3 years after the night in question.
Correct.
And then sometimes, as I indicated, you're not going to know which night was in question. Whatever. What kind of details do you expect other than your mandatory tabs system that a person could say other than, look, we enforce that. I walk around and check people and...
But, you know, sometimes you're going to get a case that occurs quickly, and summary judgment is going to be an easy way of dealing with it because people's minds are fresh.
Usually it's going to be 3 or 4 years after.
And if you have a good record retention policy and you have a system that looks good on paper like theirs does, and you have actually followed it and retained the documents that, you know, that exculpate you.
But you would mandate written documents. Let me get a word in edgewise.
You've been
cut off enough times today.
Yes.
It is not enough for the guy to give details. I walked around every 30 minutes. I looked. I remember this guy, as he says here, and we did not encourage this drink. Not enough.
He didn't say that in this. And he didn't say that he had actually followed all of their procedures. If he had testified...
Manager's not going to have to sit with all of his patrons and watch.
Oh, I know.
The manager is never going to be able to watch all the patrons. So I'm trying to see, does it have to be, in your view, we're going to have a manager walking around checking people off in the bar?
No. I think that if
he can orally testify.
He can orally testify about what he did that night. Or what
And on the other side, can the plaintiff just come in? It wouldn't be enough to carry a burden once the burden shifted for plaintiffs to say, the employees got me drunk, because by definition, it's got to be the employer's act, not the employee.
I think he has to show that there was an encouragement, some act that was an encouragement.
Talk about the free drink policy and how it was followed or not followed that night.
The free drink policy? Yes.
And how it was or was not followed?
It was not followed. They don't give free drinks except unless there's a grand opening. This was. Only the manager can give a free drink or authorize it. Secondly, that when a free drink is given, there's a comp ticket filled out. And then the manager also checks periodically to make sure that they're not giving away a bunch of free drinks. And that policy was not followed. At least there was no evidence that it was followed on that night.
You say in your brief that the record will show the manager served at least two of the drinks. Does the record reflect whether he was served those drinks when he was obviously intoxicated?
We don't know that. That we don't know.
That would make a difference, wouldn't it?
It might, but then under a some evidence rule, I don't think so.
Well, you've got to have some evidence. You've got to have some evidence they...
The manager encouraged the policy
to serve people when they're drunk, and if it's when he walked in the door and was obviously sober and you gave him two drinks, that's not going to be enough.
Well, if the policy is not to give but one free drink and the manager is actually the one giving him, that's showing that the corporation, because the manager is a vice principal in this case. If you look at his sworn testimony that that he was the boss at this particular place, he supervised the employees.
You've got a higher standard than the statute, which is one free drink is it, which the statute doesn't require.
No, just, I'm just saying just, that...
The statute would allow you to give free drinks until they're drunk.
No.
Why not?
No, wait. Rephrase your question.
It would allow you to give free drinks to them until they are obviously intoxicated.
That the statute would, but the alcoholic the TABC regulations would not. We didn't get into that in the brief because that wasn't an issue.
Counsel, the opposing counsel said we need to look at the word encourage here. Is the fact that you have a violation, the fact that you have, on this occasion, multiple drinks, if you assume an obviously intoxication, the fact that you have that violation on this occasion, is that enough evidence, in your view, to raise an inference of encouraging violating a policy, or is that simply evidence that the policy was violated on this occasion?
Right. When you combine the fact, one of which is outside the scope and the other is within the scope, when you combine the fact that the man was given 10 to 15 free drinks on this occasion with the fact that the manager gave him two of the free drinks, which is a violation.
On this occasion.
And that is some evidence that the management, because the manager is the vice principal, he represents a corporation, that's the act of the corporation.
Okay.
That's some evidence that they were encouraging.
So you're saying that evidence of a violation is evidence of encouraging violating of a policy?
No. The violation itself, which is what I said was outside the scope, because that by itself would not be an act of encouragement. But when you combine it with the manager giving two of the free drinks, which is a violation of the company policy, it shows that the manager was actually encouraged.
It shows that the manager violated.
And he is the corporation.
Okay.
So you don't have a mere employee violating. You have the manager violating it, and that means the corporation's violating it, and the corporation is incurring.
Okay, so a corporate violation on one occasion, in your mind, equates to encouraging violation of the policy. Simply one
it could.
Event.
It would be some evidence that would relieve you from summary judgment. Well, it's probably not going to prove your case to a jury.
So what is encouragement? What does encouragement mean?
Encouragement means that you're participating in the act of employees, in this instance, giving away a lot of free drinks to people.
Encouragement does...
It can be...
No, I've only been interrupted once today.
I'm sorry.
Encouragement,
I'm not interrupted anymore.
No, I know. Encouragement does seem to have some deliberate feature to it. I mean, it would be an odd thing to say someone encouraged you and you went to the person and said, did you know you were encouraging this person? And I had no idea. It's usually there's some sort of intention that happen. And why is that not the case here?
Well, because of the words before it, directly or indirectly. Directly encourage is going to require intent and positive action. The indirect part of it takes the positive action out of it. So you cannot just look at the word encouragement all by itself. You have to look at the two modifiers that the legislature put in there. Any other questions?
So what if the manager was negligent? Manager went out to each supper instead of staying around the bar, went to each supper and stayed for an hour and a half to watch the football game or something. Is that one event while the extra drinks were served? Is that one event of negligence enough to find encouragement?
I don't think so, because he wasn't there at that time encouraging. Now, they had a pattern of allowing, you know, free drinks to be served, and the manager was constantly leaving when he's supposed to be there, then you might have a pattern of encouragement, but not on one single event, I don't think.
Does the enforcement have to be on the night in question? Would it be enough for a defendant to show, here's all our policies? Affidavit says, I enforce all those policies. For instance, on this day I did this, and that day I do that, and I generally do this. But there's nothing specific about this night. Would that be enough?
No, I don't think so.
Why?
Because I think enforcement has to be a constant and ever, you know, it has to always be in a process that's occurring. Because if you give up and don't enforce your regulations on one night, and that's the night that it happens, then...
Back to my analogy to citation. We've said, the court's appeals were throwing people out because they said, I can't find the papers. And as we said, when you've lost the papers and you don't know where they went when you were served, what more can you say? If I knew where they went, I would have them.
Sure.
So if they say, you know, we enforce the policies, but this was 3 or 4 years ago, that's just too bad.
Well, the service of papers is under the Texas Rules of Procedure, which are promulgated by a court, and a court can change those rules by the way...
We hadn't changed the citation rules in 100 years.
I understand. In this case, you have the legislature very specifically, and they had, you know, they actually had, they at the time that they passed this, they actually took the word knowingly out of the section dealing with the service to minors. And then in 2005, they put the word knowingly back in. So if the legislature had wanted knowingly, they would have done it, or they would have amended the statute before now. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I'm a little hung up on the free drinks issue.
Yes, sir.
And why the evidence about that point isn't sufficient to raise a fact question about the effectiveness of your client's policies.
Well, there's two issues with that, as I see it, Justice. Well, there's the issue of the manager serving 10 to 15, or the policy of the guy got 10 to 15 drinks that night, or that's the evidence, or the manager serving two drinks. The Manager's Act in and of itself should not be the basis of the violation of the safe harbor provision, because it's also the basis of the alleged act of overservice. With respect to the what other employees saw, there is absolutely no evidence that any employee was encouraged to violate the law that night because the manager served two drinks, allegedly served two free drinks to the plaintiff in the case. Which I think is important, especially with respect to our case, because the law requires that the employer indirectly or directly encourage the employee to violate the law. And there again, there's no evidence that any employee was encouraged to violate any law because the manager allegedly served two free drinks, which I think is an important distinction in this case and why summary judgment was proper.
Would you have to have testimony of that? I mean, if the manager is not following the policy, is that not an indirect encouragement? I mean, I don't know how you would ever prove. You'd have somebody file an affidavit and say, I knew the manager was violating the policy, but, boy, I was sticking to it. I mean, these are subtle inquiries, and I wonder, your opposing counsel raised a good point, that maybe it was not the legislature's intent to allow summary judgments on these type of cases, but to actually... If the employer or if the bar is serving obviously intoxicated people to the extent they represent a clear danger to themselves and others, high liability standard, maybe the intent was to let the facts be developed and come out as to whether there was direct or indirect encouragement. I mean, what legislative indication do we have that this was intended to be something that was easily subject to summary determination?
Justice O'Neill, the only legislative history we have is that it was intended to be an encouragement for employers to send their employees to training classes. I would submit that if the only benefit's going to be at the end of the day, i.e. the end of the trial, that they're going to prevail on an affirmative defense, that that's very little encouragement at all, because, as you know, that most of these cases are going to be settled long before that, and after only after the employer's been drugged through the litigation process, and you know, his file's exposed, all the evidence, the depositions are taken, and what have you. So I think the real encouragement would come for the employer to know that, look, if we know what the rules are, if we know where the goal line is, then we can set our policies, we can set our procedures in place, and we can focus on the goal knowing that we will at least have a fair shot at summary judgment and getting out of these cases early, regardless of whether the employee actually violated the law.
The affidavit here could be a little more detailed about what I do to enforce, couldn't it?
Justice Brister, at the time the affidavit was prepared and this case went to summary judgment, I think the most recent case we had to guide us was the Cianci case. At that point, and even today, we're still not sure if policies, having policies in place and general enforcement mechanisms around those policies, well, is sufficient. So certainly we weren't sure of that back when we did the affidavit. We had no idea that there was going to be an emphasis or a focus on the events of that night. Right. Which I think part of the question that the practical question around that ruling from the 14th is the fact that, as the court has noted, years go by, people don't remember what happened on that particular night. So
employees move on.
Do they move on? The other thing too is what if there is no violation of the law? Then how is there going to be any evidence of enforcement with respect to that night?
Do you agree it's an affirmative defense? That third element?
I do not agree that it is an affirmative defense.
Okay, the safe harbor provision as in general is.
In general, yes.
And you're just saying parts A and B.
Right.
Whether or not an affirmative defense is hard to prove according to a statute wouldn't be our concern, would it? I mean, if it's either hard or it's easy or it's intermediate, but that's legislature's written the statute as it has, and right. Why can't we just declare that's... You know, you've got to negate a negative, and that's what the statute sets up.
If we understood what it was to directly and indirectly encourage employees to violate the law, perhaps the focus on the three proceed and the procedural steps behind the safe harbor wouldn't be as key an issue. I am suggesting that in light of the case law and the development of that statute as we know today, proving a negative is impossible. And until we get some guidance from this court...
I'm not sure it's impossible, though. What if there's we've had bars right here in this town where there's a pattern of drunk drivers leaving and the TABC ultimately shuts them down, and there may not be evidence that a manager told them continue to sell, but it's certainly enough to show there's indirect encouragement for that sort of sale. Rather easy for the plaintiff to prove, and hard in that instance for the defendant to disprove, even though there's no intent or no deliberate act.
All right. And again, with respect to what the TABC does, their standards are entirely different and certainly not at issue in this case with respect to at least the safe harbor provision.
Thank you. Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
So the cause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.